Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I have as my guest André Dubuis III. He reminds me that his name rhymes with abuse, and his stories do too in a certain way. The book is called Dirty Love. It's a great title in that it's both a come on and a nightmare.
Aren't they all?
Yes. I wanted to begin by asking you, who are your people? What kind of people do you write about?
You know, that's a really hard question, because the honest answer is I don't know. They just keep coming, though, don't they? But if I look back, you know, I don't know. You know, I'll hear someone describe my characters as flawed or outsiders or people who fall between the cracks, and I just haven't met anyone who's not that. Lately I've been meeting some wealthy people who seem to be in charge, and they look like broken, falling between the cracks people to me. I think I have the secret belief that, or not so secret belief, that most of us are just winging our lives, and we're doing the best we know how to do, and we're still kind of stunned that we are where we are, whether it's a beautiful place or some place that gets all sorts of good attention, or a pretty negative place. Man, I just think it's hard to live a good, noble, loving life, and we do our best every day.
Do we do our best? Or
no,
is there...
I don't think we do our best. I think we do the best we know how to do, which is not the best we can do. You know, I haven't met a person yet, whether they're doing hard time or, you know, they're a bank president or a mother, who doesn't get out of bed trying to have the best day they know how to do. But that very same person may take a handful of barbiturates, swash down the coffee, and then take the kids to school. So, you know, I do think we, I don't know, people break my heart, man. My brother and I were talking the other day, and I just found myself saying, we both found ourselves saying, people make us cry.
Yeah.
You know,
this book has gotten a lot of advance notice, very favorable advance notice, stars in all of the journals that review books in advance. And one of them said André Dubuis's Dreiserian characters. Mm. And I thought, well, what does Theodore Dreiser mean to me anymore? Mm-hmm. Yes, an American tragedy. Mm-hmm. These are American tragedies. Yes, the terrible gap between our classes.
Mm-hmm. Which is getting worse.
Which is getting worse.
Yeah.
And the way the poor fall into that gap more readily than the rich, not to say that we all don't suffer ultimately equally, but the gap swallows the poor.
Mm-hmm.
Blue collar.
Mm-hmm.
People who come from somewhere else to cities and get eaten there.
Yeah.
And in a certain sense now, in order for that to happen, you don't have to come from a small town and go to the city. All you have to do is leave your parents' house and go to the city.
Yeah.
And you're in an environment that might be inimical.
Or leave your parents' house and get an apartment, you know, 2 miles away and try to make ends meet and stay there. You know, I know a lot of people in their 40s living with their parents, and that wouldn't have happened a generation ago. You know, you brought up blue collar. I've got this aristocratic name, but I grew up in blue collar neighborhoods, and I did blue collar work until I became a writing teacher, and they're the people I know best growing up, and I do find myself writing more about people who are one paycheck away from sitting in the street. You know, look, I think living a loving and authentic life is a daily challenge, and it's not easy, especially in a culture like ours that, I don't know even how to describe our culture, but it's deeply narcissistic and mean. I think it's a cruel culture, ultimately.
Let's talk about Marla, because that's a story where there's a character I want to feel tenderly toward, and I want her to have a Prince Charming, a rescuer, a better life. Who's Marla?
Well, Marla is in her late 20s, and she's one of these not so uncommon people who's fallen through the cracks of love. For whatever reason, it's complicated. It's not just because she's overweight. She has never made love with a man. And it's her secret that she's holding from all the people in her lives who have regular relationships. So she finds a man. A man comes to her when she thinks she never will. And she thinks this is it. The hard part of my life is over. Life is beautiful now. It's all going to be great. And the man is a normal man. He's a normal human being. He has flaws. And she has to learn to live with his flaws. And it points out her own. And she quickly discovers that being in a relationship is not, it's not a state of being. This whole notion of wife, husband, lover, it's not a state of being. It's actually a job description with a list of tasks. And it's more of a verb than a noun. And that story doesn't go anyplace really, really hopeful.
Let's hear the first sections of Marla and get an idea of what her world, what her life is like. André Dubuis III, reading the opening paragraphs of his story, Marla.
Sometimes after dressing for work, Marla would stand at the kitchen sink with the last of her coffee and feel as if her small apartment and everything in it were props for a movie she wasn't even in, as if she were working for all this for somebody else. She was 29 years old and had been a teller at Providential Bank for 8 years. She owned a Honda two-door, and her bedroom closet was full of large, tasteful outfits with shoes to match. In her carpeted living room was a high-definition TV and DVD player enclosed in an oak cabinet with glass doors, the bottom shelves filled with workout discs she never used, beneath musicals from the 40s she watched once or twice a month. Alone again on a Saturday night, she'd curl up on the couch with a bowl of buttered popcorn and watch two movies back to back. She'd listen to the orchestra's manly horns and womanly strings and watch men who could sing and dance their leading ladies into a swoon under the stars over a glittering sea, and Marla would pull her cat Edna into her lap and stroke her head till she purred, and she'd try to pretend she wasn't miserable, even with all she had. On Thursday nights, she'd go out with her friends from the bank, usually to Pedro Diego's downtown because they had 9 kinds of margaritas and they kept the place lit up in an aquamarine light. It made the tiled cocktail tables, the huge cacti in the corners, and the straw sombreros hanging on the wall all seem to be in an underwater tequila dream. And when she was a little drunk, she always felt prettier or maybe just more hopeful or reckless, which occurred to her once might be the same thing. She'd borrow 1 or 2 cigarettes from Lisa's pack of Marlboros, and she'd suck her peach margarita through the straw, laugh at Nancy's nasty jokes, listen to Nancy bitch about their supervisor Dorothy, who was 56 years old and seemed to have married the bank 25 years earlier. But there was a sadness in Dorothy's eyes, even when she was briskly handing you a memo making your job more tedious. If you looked past the hard lines of her face, her short, unstylish hair, you could see how dark and sad her eyes really were. Not pissed off, the way the other girls saw her, but melancholy, lonely, Marla was sure.
André Dubuis, reading from the opening of his story, Marla. So, we're told very discreetly that she has large, nice clothing.
Mm.
Way immediately of saying she's heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And she's proud of the things she's assembled around her. TV, DVD, and what she likes, musicals.
Mm.
Reference to an earlier kind of life where romance and music and a swoon.
Mm.
Is a part of the vision of the future.
Right.
She dreams a lot. She strokes her cat's head.
Mm-hmm.
We all know about the unconditional love of dogs, mm-hmm. but the unconditional love of cats is a different matter.
Mm.
She's not used to an affection that's nonstop. Mm-hmm. Any cat lover has to accept that.
That's
I
right.
do.
That's right.
And as I read, I realize that I, too, am Marla. Mm-hmm. That is to say, I love things that are no longer loved in my culture. She loves musicals. I love to read. Late at night, sitting up with a book. Well, wouldn't a companion spoil that? So Marla's friends, well, they know Marla hasn't slept with anyone.
Right.
The only rule here is that no one's allowed to say it.
Right.
And when it is said, it's said in the form of a cruel joke. And unless Marla wants to run away from the table in tears, she doesn't get to install her rules of self-protection.
Exactly.
On her others. So she's living always at the edge, the most attackable edge of any social community.
Yeah, I think it's beautifully put. You know, it's weird, man. I think in so many ways writers keep writing about the same things. We tend to keep writing from the same wound or the same. I think it is a wound often. You know, so many of my characters, and I think Marla in particular, reacts to her life. You know, reacts. Oh, yes, I'm supposed to be doing this. I'm supposed to look this way. I'm supposed to have this and then be this. And that keeps her from responding to her life, as she might have in that scene when she said, you know, don't make a joke about my weight when I'm telling you I'm in love with a man and I'm giving myself sexually to him for the first time. This is sacred. Don't tell a dirty joke when I'm talking sacredly about my heart. But she, and these are her only friends.
And you manage, and I'd say that this is where the tension of a story comes. You manage to put your characters in a situation of damned if you do, damned if you don't. If she leaves her apartment and her nice things, well, she's not going to be alone anymore, but she's going to be accepting a lot of values that aren't hers. And this guy plays Call of Duty all night and loves gory stuff, and he's, you know, yeah, he's capable of loving her. He knows he is, but not beyond his abilities and not into her territory of what she thinks love is. He would just say, well, that's the kind of guy I am, Marla.
Live with it. That's me, honey.
Yeah.
And then she wants children. Then she starts to dream of a child and, you know, to take that love, that dream to the next level of intimacy and intensity and realization. And it's not something he wants. And I've known too many women who've wanted babies and their men have not, and they've just allowed the dream to wither. And it makes me sad.
Yeah, now, so tell me, this sadness, okay? You're capturing it on the page. Sometimes I think, I can't help it, I think that you take pot shots.
Like really?
You tell us, yeah, you tell us that Marla wouldn't know the name of the Dutch artist, and if she did, she wouldn't be able to pronounce it. I think she knows that name and she can pronounce it. Plenty of people can pronounce Van Gogh or Vermeer. It's not that hard. I think that sometimes you insist a little bit too hard on the deprived nature of these people. They're not as deprived.
But you know what? I think what you're getting from me in that is my own profound ignorance about many things. And I write about this in my, you know, actual memoir, Tony. The truth is I hadn't heard of Manhattan until I was 19. I still learn things. I still learn how ignorant I am about a lot of things. So, I mean, in that moment, yeah, it's a Flemish painter whose name she can't pronounce. And I think I'm projecting my own ignorance about things there, that it's I who can't pronounce the name.
Well, it's wild because one of the things that I love is that I think that sometimes when a blue-collar person is writing about blue-collar people, we're not writing above. Now, bear in mind, I come from Bayside, Queens.
I know.
I'm not talking about a world I don't know. But you have another story here called Bartender. The story could have been called Poet. He's someone who wants to be a poet, but the nature of blue-collar writing about blue-collar people is that this guy is not going to get to be a good poet no matter what he does. And it's our way of punishing our own. Why isn't he a good poet? It's not as if he were a good poet, he'd have an easier track.
Yeah.
It's a lousy life anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, but he doesn't even get to be a good one. She doesn't even get to know how to pronounce the name of the artist whose print she hangs up.
Yeah.
Why do we want to insist that we are doubly deprived? If he likes poetry to begin with, why can't he be a decent poet? Mm.
Yeah.
You tell me, you're a decent writer.
You know, it's. I think that the bartender, I think, again, this whole notion of characters coming from the dream world and the psyche of the writer, and oftentimes their origin is a mystery. In this one, I think the bartender came from a man I worked with. I was a bartender for 12, 13 years. And all through my 20s, I worked in many bars. And I think this came from a waiter I worked with actually in New York who was seriously addicted to alcohol and cocaine, and who lied on a daily basis about the novel he was writing. And it wasn't until years later that I realized he was never writing. He was always talking about writing. But that broke my heart about him, that the thing that he wanted most, he never even did. And what he really did was he would drink and screw around. And so he shows up in the character of Robert Doucette in The Bartender, and I just allowed it. But it's interesting. It goes against my general experience with most artists I've met, whether they're actors, writers, dancers. A lot of them come from the working class. Certainly the ones I admire most, and I'm not putting down my middle class or upper class brothers and sisters out there, but, you know, so it's nothing I'm trying to say about the blue collar. Come on, Bruce Springsteen? He's my favorite guy.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with André Dubuis III about his book, Dirty Love. We'll continue after this short break.
I'm Connie Alvarez, producer of Bookworm. Check out our other KCRW programs in the podcast section of iTunes. Shows like DNA, Good Food, The Treatment, Unfictional, and The Business. Or listen on KCRW smartphone apps. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with André Dubuis III about his new book, Dirty Love, a series of novellas connected not only by characters, but also by hope and yearning for love, sensuality, and identity. Now, the longest story here is called Dirty Love, and in a way it's about the future, because Marla is a character that we know from the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And now we're meeting Devin, and she's a character who lives right now with her I everything.
Mm-hmm.
What is her condition? What's her circumstance?
Well, the story opens from her point of view. She's 18 years old. She's living in a beachfront town in New Hampshire. Hampton, New Hampshire actually exists, with her 81-year-old great-uncle Francis. She's fleeing her home where her father's been cheating on her mother. And more importantly, she's fleeing a pornographic little video of her on the internet. And she's fleeing a broken relationship, and she's really just withdrawing. So she's working in the same bar where Robert Doucette from The Bartender works. She's trying to reorient herself and do the next thing. And her great uncle Francis is a recovering alcoholic. He's also newly widowed, and he's a retired school teacher. And his deal is if she lives with him rent free, she's got to do GED study classes with him because he wants her to get her GED.
Well, she's also, Devin, a disguised Marla. She's not fat, but she lives having her nice things. Those are her studs and her brads and her equipment, her
Dr.
iPods.
Dre's.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And unlike Marla, she's allowed herself to be convinced by other girls her own age, that if nothing else, she has to learn to give oral sex. And that she becomes gifted and values herself because of this ability. And once she enters that circle, a different kind of girl won't talk to her. And girls who are jealous take videos of her. And eventually yet another video, this taken by boys, gets put up on the web on a site called Dirty Devon. After that, I don't know if you're that age, you don't want to live much anymore.
Yeah, man, this is, that character I'm sure has come from having an 18-year-old daughter myself.
What's her name?
Ariadne, and she's a beautiful dancer and very strong, and not like Devon, in some ways not like Devon at all, in other ways she is. I think there's a deep strength in Devon, and there's a deep sense of outrage that she is living the life she is, and she has a hand in the life she's living. I'm really nervous about young people now, and this whole, there's a real point of a, what's the word, this whole notion of sex as a contact sport, and I think, I mean, haven't you seen this just in the last 15, 20 years? You know, young women have always been objectified, but they are so much more objectified now, it seems to me, in the age of the internet and ubiquitous pornography, and I think it's a, it was one little sliver of hope and this desire to live that made her call her great Uncle Francis, you know, at 3 a.m, can I come live with you? And of course, you know, Devon is still playing with the poison that poisoned her, because at night what she does is goes on chat roulette and hits buttons and goes to places around the world where strangers are looking at strangers.
And like Marla, at heart, however tough she talks or tough she looks, she's a romantic. And so when someone says endearing, lost, crack up things to her, she wants to run and help. That's what she is.
Right.
You know, she's become a person who needs to be needed, kind of classically codependent, and so she is capable of being duped by any neediness that presents itself to her.
You know, the way you describe it is depressing the hell out of me. you, Michael Silverblatt. But it's, I really admire how deeply you receive these characters and their stories, because it's at that level of depth I'm trying to find them. You know, I do think that there's more hope in that story than in Marla, though. I think that I don't know if Devon in the end is going to find immediate salvation and love and light, but I think she's on a road that she may find herself and get there.
Well, I think that in the sex stories of the 60s, sex and sexual discovery were a form of, well, becoming the hero of your own life, taking your life into your hands. Today, kids fall into the degradation of the culture that pre-exists.
Yes, it happens to them.
It happens to them.
It seems to be, exactly. Thank you. You've just helped me figure this out. They are passive recipients of a sexual culture. And I would say more of a pornographic culture than a sexual culture, as opposed to, you're right, reaching out and finding an essential part of their spiritual selves through their sexuality. You're right. There's been a big shift in that way.
What's great about Devon is that at the end of the story, she's finally on her own road. So that things that happen can happen to her because of her, not because she's been in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right, and she literally does this by putting her hands literally on the wheel of a car and driving somewhere she wants to go.
You say to us when she borrows this car, she's not stealing it, she will never steal anything.
Right.
And that's a case where the author is giving us a prediction that's very generous, because he knows this character. There are things that she won't do. There are things she will do. She'll get in trouble for some of them, but there are integrities that she has that he knows about right now, even though he may not know, this author, what's going to happen to her. He knows she won't destroy herself that way.
It's interesting. You just give me an insight into my own process here. You know, as I've gotten older at this, into my whatever 30 years writing, I've allowed myself a little bit more godlike, omniscient authority that I wouldn't have the chutzpah to even try to do 10, 15 years ago. So I've always tried to write deeply from within a character instead of from without a character. But I have allowed myself to have a little bit more of an authorial presence just because, you know, I'm in my 50s, damn it. I have a couple things to say. And I think it might be helping.
I think, you see, we've talked about three of the four pieces in this book, but I think it's possible for anyone to read any of these stories and feel a deep sense of identity.
Good.
And to feel that this author, although he may expect the worst to happen, is also strangely optimistic about our ability to resuscitate. Are you?
Yeah, you know, God, you can run, but you can't hide, right? When you write, my own view, just as me, is, and my wife will tell you this, that I'm always expecting disaster, always, yet I always hope for the best on a daily level. You know, there's no horrible thing that can happen that I didn't expect right around the corner. It's just, I don't know why I'm that way. But I'm also, I think, one of the most upbeat, enthusiastic, optimistic guys around, because I so believe in people's resilience. And I so believe in people's ability to change, by the way.
Have you ever ruined a story either by excessive optimism or pessimism?
House of Sand and Fog, the book that puts me on the map, feels to me like I ruined it with excessive pessimism. It is such a black ending to that story. You know, it's my most famous one I've written, and it still haunts me. I wish a better writer had written it. I think there could have been a few more molecules of hope at the end of that damn tale.
You know, Dickens wrote two endings for Great Expectations, the second a much happier one, and we have both.
Okay, are you making an invitation?
Well, why not? Yeah,
I'll call it House of Sand and Fog, the condo, too. Condo of Sand and Fog.
I've been talking with Andrew DeVuce III, author most recently of Dirty Love, published by W.W. Norton & Company. Thank you, Andrew, for joining me.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demands with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Robert Dewhurst. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Alice McDermott is our guest.